unconsciously or sometimes just without really focusing on it, we're always responding to the musicality of the patient's voice. But I think that that careful listening and study of opera really kind of hones our ability to do that. We pay more attention to it, and we can potentially make not just unconscious use of it, but also conscious use of it. You know, as we listen to how the music itself is conveying the story that the patient is telling, it's not necessarily the same story as the words are telling. What's often interesting is that the music, the musicality of the voice, whether it's in opera or in the consulting room, often is at variance with the spoken text. And that opens up interesting opportunities, you know, for generating meaning.
The tendency is first to think that the text that's being sung is all important, and that the melody and the orchestration behind it, especially the orchestra behind it, are supporting the purpose of the aria. And that is true in maybe certainly in Italian opera general. These are sweeping generalizations, but in popular Italian operas, that's definitely the case, that the music seems to, from the orchestra and of the melody, seems to support the overall message. But because of Wagner's influence in wanting to have an orchestra, an orchestration that actually comments on the action on stage as a second opinion, you get into more complex music where often the orchestra is playing something that reminds the listener of a previous theme, a motif, that complexifies the actual aria being sung.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guests today are Drs. Steven Goldberg and Lee Rather, both from the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. And our conversation today revolves around the relationship between opera and psychoanalysis. They've edited a book on the subject called Opera on the Couch: Music, Emotional Life, and Unconscious Aspects of Mind, where we spend a great deal of time really on two ways of thinking about this. The first is the more well-known, which is that opera has the potential to convey emotional complexity and conflict on multiple levels. But they add another piece to it, and that is that they feel that opera can contribute to psychoanalysis by attuning the analyst's ear to listen to this complexity on multiple levels, to listen to the music, to listen to the song, to listen to the manifest content of the libretto, to observe the acting, that it more closely than just music resembles the analytic encounter. This is something they've been teaching for many years at the in the collaboration that they have called Opera on the Couch. It's a work between the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and the San Francisco Opera. Dr. Goldberg, beyond that, is a training and supervising analyst at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and a personal and supervising analyst at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California. He is currently an associate editor of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and in addition to Opera, he's published on a variety of theoretical and technical issues in psychoanalysis, in addition to his interest in Opera. Dr. Rather is on the faculties of the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis and the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, where he is both a personal and supervising analyst. He, too, has published and presented on a wide range of topics, including the integration of psychoanalytic theories, the existential dynamics of desire, mourning, and acceptance, and the unconscious aspects of creativity in drama, literature, and music, and he is in private practice in San Francisco. We play musical excerpts from The Magic Flute, which is our clinical example, as it were, to have a piece of opera demonstrate all the facets we just said, in addition to gorgeous music. I very much enjoyed our time together. It, as I mentioned, it allowed me to get reacquainted with this opera, and it's really a treat, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Steve and Lee, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you both here. You know, when we talk about analysis, even when we write about it, it is common to use musical metaphors. We hear phrases of harmonious and melodic or dissonant, and certainly improvisation. But it's less often than we hear operatic references, even though many analysts are serious students of the art form. And in fact, it was one serious student of the art form, my friend and colleague, Anna Ballas, who alerted me to your book. And Anna has her own chapter in your book, a deeply personal chapter, on Bartok's soul opera, Duke Bluebeard's Castle, which I highly recommend. But in introducing me to you and your work, and again, the title of your book is Opera on the Couch, Music, Emotional Life, and Unconscious Aspects of Mind. You dive deeply into many different operas and also speak about the interface between opera and analysis. And there are many phrases in your writings that caught my eye, but one of them was you say that the beauty of understanding opera is that it, quote, corrects the historical tilt towards verbal text in our field. It corrects the historical tilt towards verbal text. And we're going to spend time on that today. And we're also going to focus on one particular opera, The Magic Flute by Mozart, which is a favorite of mine for many reasons. Not only is the music exquisite, but it has always struck me, and it was so pleasing for me to read Lee's chapter on it, because it describes the developmental pathway for boys and girls as only Mozart's genius could do. He does it in a way that you don't even know he's doing it until you sit back and look at it and you see the path and the trajectory he's brought us to. And it so matches our current understanding of male and female development, but we'll get to that. I want to start us off by reading a paragraph from page one in the book, where you both write, "Psychoanalysis and opera have much to offer each other. While the same could be said about psychoanalysis and music in general, opera's unique synthesis of music, text, dramatic realization, and the communication of meanings at multiple levels offers particular opportunities for the psychoanalytic understanding and deepening appreciation of the art form. Conversely, we attempt to demonstrate that opera can open new areas of understanding for the theory and practice of psychoanalysis." Now, let me read that because it's easy to miss because it's a radical, perhaps, statement. You say, opera can open new areas of understanding
for the theory and practice of psychoanalysis. Not ordinarily how one thinks of it. But Stephen, you want to start us off with that and flesh out what you mean by that?
Yeah, thanks, Harvey. And thank you for inviting us to the podcast. And that paragraph, I think, is exceptionally well chosen because in many ways, it really underlies the purpose of the book. So there's a lot to unpack in that brief paragraph, but let me try as a kind of opening introduction. And hopefully we'll have a chance to illustrate some of these ideas that I'm going to just mention when we hear some musical examples in Lee's discussion of the magic flute. So psychoanalysis and art in general have always had a two-way relationship, although this has only more recently been focused on for music. There's a long history, of course, beginning with Freud, of psychoanalytic ideas illuminating artistic creations in various genres, mostly literature and drama. But there's also a long history of artistic productions generating important ideas in psychoanalysis. For example, the Oedipus complex, where Freud drew on Shakespeare and Sophocles. He also drew on Goethe and other German poets and so on. So we're trying to explore in our book the mutual generative contributions that psychoanalysis and opera have to each other. Now, this idea of the bidirectionality, including the what we can learn as psychoanalysts from careful listening to opera, that really emerged over time as we discussed operatic performances in a collaboration that the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis had with San Francisco Opera. And we've been doing this for over 10 years, maybe closer to 15 at this point. Initially, in these presentations, we would have two analysts who would give relatively brief psychoanalytically oriented discussions right after the performance of an opera on a Sunday afternoon. It was open to the public. Generally, it was just people who had been at the performance who would attend. And we often had quite a range of people, from psychoanalytic colleagues to opera aficionados, and you know, everybody in between. So it was really a very interesting format. And those discussions were followed by an interchange with the audience. Early on, we mostly were talking about using psychoanalytic concepts to illuminate character, motivation, and action, really. So we were focusing really more on the dramatic aspects of the opera initially. But as we got more into this over the years, and as we learned ourselves more about opera, we started really bringing in more of the music and focusing more on how the music really conveys the story, sometimes equally or even more importantly than the verbal text of the opera. And partly as a result of that endeavor, and also reading some recent contributions in the psychoanalytic literature about music and psychoanalytic listening, we began to really focus in also on how listening to opera would potentially help us in expanding our own receptivity, the range of our receptivity to what we hear in the consulting room, not only from our patients, but even from ourselves in our spoken language.
That's the fascinating part of this, that you say immersing yourself in the listening to opera. And it's perhaps because the musicality is overt, whereas in the office, we have to listen differently to hear the music. In the opera, the music is right there. And you're saying that sort of trains us to be attuned to the music in the office.
I think that's right. You know, I think that unconsciously or sometimes just without really focusing on it, we're always responding to the musicality of the patient's voice. But I think that careful listening and study of opera really kind of hones our ability to do that. We pay more attention to it, and we can potentially make not just unconscious use of it, but also conscious use of it. You know, as we listen to how the music itself is conveying the story that the patient is telling. And not necessarily, it's not necessarily the same story as the words are telling. What's often interesting is that the music, the musicality of the voice, whether it's in opera or in the consulting room, often is at variance with the spoken text. And that opens up interesting opportunities, you know, for generating meaning.
Hmm. Lee, you want to chime in on this?
Yes. First of all, thank you again, Harvey, for inviting us. Steve mentioned a really interesting point that not all opera goers and lovers may be aware of. It depends on the kind of operas they gravitate towards. The tendency is first to think that the text that's being sung is all important, and that the melody and the orchestration behind it, especially the orchestra behind it, are supporting the purpose of the aria. And that is true in certainly in Italian opera general. These are sweeping generalizations, but in popular Italian operas, that's definitely the case, that the music seems to, from the orchestra and of the melody, seems to support the overall message. But because of Wagner's influence in wanting to have an orchestration that actually comments on the action on stage as a second opinion, you get into more complex music where often the orchestra is playing something that reminds the listener of a previous theme, a motif that complexifies, I'm sorry to make up a word, complexifies the actual aria being sung. So you really have a polyphonic voice. Perhaps you have orchestra, you have vocal, the words themselves, the melody of the aria, and then in opera, of course, you have the gestures, the acting, and so on. So you can get it's a very complex art form. I think it's pretty unusual in bringing in poetry, music, drama, complexity in music. And so as analysts, we can learn a lot from it, and we can shed a lot of light on what's going on when we explore those things.
Are you making a distinction or a generalization between Italian and German opera?
I'm making a distinction, I think, between the talent, genius, and goal of the composer, and of the composer in particular. I'm assuming that there's a, for example, I just saw La Traviata performed at the San Francisco Opera House. The orchestration is 100% in union with the action on the stage and the arias. There's no complexity. I don't mean that in a bad way. It's a thrilling ride.
Yeah, sure.
Right to the point. You don't have to think much. It just carries you along like a good aria. Whereas if you dip into Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung, you have something quite different, where the orchestration is commenting, reminding, reminiscing, all the while supporting. So I don't want to make too rigid a distinction, and I don't want to do any injustice to any composer or a musicologist, but I think the goals can be more straightforward, like entertainment, you know, or they can be great art and thorough commentary. And opera contains, it's old enough now that you have many, many registers of possibility for composers to step into.
And it's such a nice parallel with the clinical experience.
But there was a beautiful example of some of this at the very, we don't have a chapter on La Traviata in the book, but I'll just say that at the end, Violetta is the love interest is dying of tuberculosis, and time is just running out. She's just on her last legs. And as she's singing her aria, what I noticed was that at certain moments, she would get behind the beat and the orchestra would slow down. And it was very subtle, but it was very moving and very compelling, as though time, it was a way of conveying the idea that time was running out. And simultaneously, we're hearing music from earlier at a much happier moment in her life, but now in a very minor and diminished kind of register. And it just conveys this whole world of emotion and psychological life that the text alone can't convey. And that this was something we had talked before about, this quote from Wagner that I...
don't you read that? It's a wonderful quote. Yeah.
He wrote this after he had shared the text of one of his operas, but not yet the music. So he writes, "Wait until you hear the work with the music. That will make everything plain to you. In terms, however, not of words, which are a clumsy tool created by human reflection, but of feeling. For music, which comes from the foundations, not the surface, of man and things, is capable of 1,000 shades of suggestion that are beyond the capacity of words." So it's a, you know, very compelling statement about opera and our appreciation of opera, but can't we equally appreciate that and be more receptive to it in the consulting room? Again, as music, the music of the voice, enters the consulting room.
Well, I think everything you've said is so applicable to the clinical situation. Whether the music and the words are in sync, which offers its own challenges to unpack, and other times when they are not in sync, when they're in fact in contrast, which offers a different countertransference experience and a different challenge to bring or invite curiosity and then meaning on the part of the analyst. And it's wonderfully applicable. I want us to move to the magic flute only because it's such a wonderful chapter. B, we're going to listen to the music, and C, it represents everything that we've been saying. So let me start us off by reading Lee from your chapter on the magic flute to introduce it. You write, "The deep structure of the magic flute is essentially a developmental story of boys and girls needing to situate themselves in relation to mothers and fathers, or more specifically, to maternal and paternal function, as elaborated in the following and represented allegorically by the Queen and Zarathustra. In this sense, the magic flute resonates deeply because it portrays the challenging unconscious emotional dynamics involved in individuating away from the mother and encountering the world of the father. Psychoanalysis considers this journey essential as part of growth and maturity." And while we unpack that and listen to the music, I want to alert the listener to, Lee, your contention and conjecture about that journey doesn't end with individuating away from the mother and embracing the world of the father. That is a premature end. And that the third, which you characterize it as the missing third act, and one could say analytically the missing third space, where things are not binary, mother or father, but are creatively ambiguous, which is, of course, the analytic space as well, that too is either understood as omitted by Mozart or, more wisely, left in the hands of the audience to create on their own, which is my vote. But we'll get to that. Why don't you start us off with the magic flute? Tell us a little bit about the synopsis. I trust not everybody listening is familiar with it. And then we're going to play some very characteristic 4 brief excerpts of song and music that really bring alive many of these points.
Would you mind if I took a minute or so to contextualize what you read?
Please do.
I don't in any way attribute my reading of the magic flute to anything intended by Mozart. And this is very important. the different approaches to opera. Steve and I kind of catalog them a bit in our introductory chapter. There are three or four basic approaches that characterize the chapters in our book. The first is to take the opera and use the material of the opera to analyze the composer and or librettist. That's sort of the Freudian, that's the kind of thing that Freud liked to do in looking at artworks. He was not interested in the artwork so much as what it revealed about the artist. So that's one approach. The second approach is to treat all the characters in an opera like they were real people, as if you had a caseload of the characters in The Magic Flute, for example, and you're analyzing them individually. I have tended towards a third approach, which is to take the arc of the dramatic story and treat it as not as made of individual characters, but as a kind of psychodrama that conveys a myth or narrative about development or just being alive. And so that's what I did with The Magic Flute. And it led me to give a reading of it for which I think fairly cannot be, the reading cannot be attributed to Schikaneder or Mozart. It has to be attributed to Rather, who is trying to play with the ideas a little bit. And so I believe that they intended this opera to illustrate Freemason initiation rites and principles. But what I'm interested in is what is the appeal of it over time for all the people who have no interest in Freemasonry and so on. And so my interpretation is to treat the opera a little bit like an allegory that illustrates and fleshes out a psychological theme.
Just to mention, Schikaneder is the librettist.
Schikaneder is the librettist, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so this, just a brief synopsis, and it'll just stick to the most pertinent high points of the story. First of all, I'll say that this opera is enormously popular, like you mentioned, Harvey. I think the Met has, at last count, had performed it about 340 times.
Mm. And they now have a family version available for the holidays for children, a briefer version, and it's made in English, right?
It's a bit like the Nutcracker.
Exactly.
It is to play what Magic Flute is to opera. And there are good reasons for that. There, it can be, the number of parts are deliberately comic. They can be played by the stage director as slapstick. You have a dragon, you have a bird catcher, sort of half man, half bird. You have a king, a queen, you have a damsel in distress. You have all the makings of a fairy tale. And it can be colorfully produced, and the music just soars. So it's the fairy tale itself is not seamless. That's the problem. But the appeal is seamless. Now here's the fairy tale synopsis. We start off with a handsome prince who's being chased by a dragon. He's scared to death and he faints. When he's revived by three women who we learn are attendants of the Queen of the Night, he's saved and revives himself, and he meets this bird catcher, Papageno, who claims to have killed the dragon with his bare hands, kind of childish boast. We have the appearance of the Queen of the Night, and we'll hear the aria where she appears, and she presents herself as a tragic figure of injustice. Her daughter has been kidnapped. She is a victim, and she needs the help of the young man and his sidekick to rescue her kidnapped daughter from an evil man. And that sets the action in motion, because she shows the prince a picture of her daughter. He, of course, falls in love instantly, and sets out with his comic sidekick, Papageno, to go to the palace, the fortress, it's unclear, where the evil man lives, and rescue her. The strange disjunction occurs that when they get finally to the palace, it turns out to be a temple of wisdom, and they no longer are that devoted to rescuing the princess, and they're much more devoted to the initiation rites of the temple. And it's gradually revealed that the evil man is not evil at all. In fact, he's a high priest of wisdom. He's calm. He's trustworthy. He's not vengeful. But the mother then appears, the queen of the night. And she, by contrast, is no longer a damsel in distress herself. She's an angry, angry, vengeful woman who brings a dagger, wants her daughter to take it to kill Zoroastro, the wise man, and threatens to disown the daughter if she doesn't do it. Okay. All right. So various things happen after that, initiation rites. And at the end, the prince and the princess end up together. The birdcatcher finds a comical sidekick. His name's Papageno. Hers is Papagena. It ends in a celebratory mode of couples unions and the defeat of the Queen of the Night. I hope you can follow that. But the weird thing is, when it all finishes, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, what happened? How come I thought he was the bad guy and she was the aggrieved mother? But then by the time we got to the palace, he was the good guy and she was the vengeful queen. And it's not explained in the opera. You're just left with it. And so many people have just written it off as a nonsense plot. Our own local opera critic did so in a review while I was writing my chapter. This is just a bunch of incoherent nonsense, doesn't make sense. And then people step in and say, well, that's because it was not really completed. Mozart died about the time that the premiere was scheduled. And so it's an incomplete opera. But if you are intrepid and look further, you'll find that there's a huge amount of literature written analyzing the Magic Flute from the Masonic perspective. And I think it's very compelling and probably does represent the conscious intent of Schikaneder Mozart to promote Freemasonry. But that doesn't explain why it's remained so interesting to all audiences over the year. And that's where I suggest we feel some resonance for this change, this inexplicable change from mother good to sort of mother bad, father good.
Let me, if I may, just add a couple of points to your synopsis that I think make your point, and these are from your chapter. You make the point that at the very beginning, Tamino, the character,
the prince
sent by the queen to rescue the daughter. For her purposes, the mother's purposes. In the opening scene, you point out he is with a bow, but without an arrow. And you characterize the opera as his search for an arrow, his own adultness, his own maleness. And in fact, the metaphoric arrow is provided by the magic flute, a wood flute, that the mythology says was actually carved by Zoroastro, who is his wife's to be father. She didn't know this, but her father carves the magic flute from a 1,000-year-old oak tree, and that comes to belong to Tamino. And I think that adds to your thesis that this is a developmental progression, that the boy discovers an identification with a father who encourages that identification and encourages his phallic autonomy from the mother and also his sexuality towards Zarastro's daughter, Pamina. And yes. I read it as you read it, which is that it's lasted so long, not simply because of the music, but because it speaks on an unconscious level to things that we all live with.
I think that's absolutely right. And you can see in the prince is sort of an adolescent type of character. He falls sexual romantic love with the photograph. Papagena is, I think I write in my chapter that he's thinking of Papageno. If he ever gets a Papagena, they'll just have kind of a slumber fest, you know, slumber party. It's
That's
more
the young version of him.
Young version. Yeah. And in fact, as their journey sets out to get to the to Zarastro's temple, they're guided by three boys. So there's the whole sense of youth, mostly male youth. But we can't leave out to Mina. It's just she plays more of a second string character here in a way. Mm-hmm. The developmental problem is, should the boy have to totally reject the mother in order to accept the gifts of the father? And that is something of a trope in attachment gender studies that posit that the boy has a hard task of renouncing his feminine identification with his mother during the course of development and has to somehow make it across the great divide, I call it, over to the father for the rest of his identification. But it sets up a fearful relationship between what he regards as his masculine qualities and that he should have and his feminine qualities that he shouldn't have. And of course, this is everyday clinical work. I would dare say it's rare in my practice to not have a man who doesn't worry about his masculinity. But it's also rare in my practice to have a woman worried that she's not feminine enough.
I reference, for those who want to pursue this further, the work of and my conversation with Michael Diamond, who has written just on this very issue about how rejecting the mother is not really a clinically astute way to think about it. It's how does one integrate the mother, which is your point too. How does one integrate one's mother and one's father, which is what you say the opera leaves out, which we'll get to at the end.
Yes.
Why don't we turn to the music? You have four brief examples that demonstrate not only the characters, but the power of the music to make a point about the unconscious life of the characters and ourselves and how these so readily represent imagos in our mind. So why don't you start us off?
Okay. And Steve, I really would like you to jump in commenting on the music and the character that we're playing, because I know that that's following the thread that you've already introduced.
Yeah, sure. Can I just ask one? I just have one question for Lee that we haven't really talked about. Does the music itself is a presence, is almost a character in the opera. Does the music itself represent some synthesis of male and female? You know, of course, the flute is phallic, but it's the music that brings them through the trials, you know, to their receiving wisdom and entrance into the temple. It's the music that protects them from, you know, various dangers along the way. It brings up, you know, another myth, which is the Orpheus myth, and that it's the music that allows the coming together of the male and the female. So that was something that I was thinking about and wondering.
It's a great question. It points towards another paper.
Is it? Do you mean, Steve, that the magic quality of the flute is that synthesis? The magic borrowing from the earlier magical mother queen versus and the phallicness of the father identification. That's what brings the magic flute is by definition a combination that might offer that synthesis.
Yeah, that takes my thought even further. I was thinking really more about just the nature of the music itself. And what is so transporting about the music, and what brings the male and the female together in the
opera. Mm-hmm. Great. Let's listen.
Don't forget the other musical instrument. It's not just a flute. There's also a set of magic bells. And I don't know, you get a flute and pair it with a couple bells, and it certainly looks like something to me.
Tell us about the first piece and who sang it and the context.
I chose as the first piece the aria in which Papageno introduces himself. It's called the Birdcatcher aria, and he portrays himself as a birdcatcher who trades. Well, we find out that he catches birds and trades them to the attendants of the Queen of the Night, who then give him food to eat. So he's a dependent kind of playful child, happy-go-lucky, and you'll hear it, I think, in this particular vocal performance, as well as the music itself. So let me go to that selection. It'll be about 45.
This is the boy child.
This is not the prince. This is
The prince. This is the childlike version.
The most cartoon character in it that the kids love. And but he's a young, innocent, playful. He doesn't have to worry about damsels in distress, although he'd like a playmate if he could get one. Mm-hmm. So let me play his aria here. The words he's singing, he's describing that he's beloved by all, and he's completely happy if he can just catch a lot of birds.
I'm reminded, as I'm sure many of us are, of patients who come in, especially initially, in a childlike cadence. They might be high-pitched, but I'm thinking of somebody who had a young, he was not a young child, but he sounded like a young child, both in his high-pitched voice and his very clipped, sort of clownish way of being. And we discovered that this emerged from many factors, obviously, but essentially from a defensive identification with a very depressed mother. And he had to sort of be her Papagena to keep her company. And over the course of time, his voice deepened, his cadence changed, and he became much more of a Tamino. And he was able to go out into the world and negotiate the world and negotiate what it meant for him to be a man. And I now have the pleasure of reading your book and bringing these images to mind, of having them in my mind when thinking of this patient scene some time ago. So thank you for that. And I'm sure many have examples like that.
Yeah, it reminds us of certain patients It also, I think, reminds us of certain aspects, you know, of many patients that, you know, sometimes we speak in many voices, you know, over time in the consulting room. And this is, you know, a kind of lilting, upbeat, nonchalant, you know, all is well in the world. Often defensive, as you say, Harvey, kind of quality to the voice. And sometimes, you know, I've also had people who were very, very funny, you know, joking a lot and are very funny, but often, you know, after deeper conversation, it turns out that there's a lot of sadness and loss that's being defended against.
And that's what I understand you both to mean by saying how the clinical setting can be deepened by our practiced ear listening to these characters. It helps that they're created by geniuses, but in that they have nuance to it, and the musicality, like you say, plays off it and challenges it and agrees with it. But I'm finding more understanding of what you mean when you say it helps us develop our ears.
This isn't really a place to go into it, but just I listen to voices a lot, the voices clinically, voices on the radio, and you can hear often cultural differences. I don't mean in accents. I mean where the voice is projected from. These days, for example, it's somewhat unusual to have, say, a reporter, a youngish, say, 20 to 35 NPR reporter who doesn't have a rather high-sounding voice, ending with upticks. What they call a kind of a vocal gravel. There are styles, a vocal fry, it's called. There are styles of this.
Vocal fry, F-R-Y?
Yeah, it's where you don't let all the air out, and you kind of, I don't know if I can imitate it in Mr. Smith was very, very intrigued on his journey. It's like listen for it and you'll hear it.
Okay.
It's supposed to give a signal of, I think, depth and intensity that isn't actually felt. And then there's the intellectual speaker, the American intellectual speaker, who can't say anything very straight out. I won't name any names, but let's say a commentator goes, okay, well, I think that's a very, interesting point. Yeah, interesting. What do you say about the sort of art of it, you know, and everything's, the voice is such a performative instrument in the style that it gravitates towards. It's just as expressive as the clothes people pick to wear. And it identifies, yeah. When I travel in Europe, which I sometimes do with my wife, I'm always surprised that everybody's voice is deeper. And the women are very, it's coming from the diaphragm. It's the full voice.
Well, that, I think that's a really important point too, that the voice is embodied in a way that the text, you know, is not in the same way. So that these musical aspects of the voice, we're responding, they're coming from, you know, from within the body, and we receive them in a bodily way as well. And that's often, you know, a way of access into the embodied quality of what's happening.
That's the point.
Even on the radio, Lee, as you were saying, you know, you almost feel just from the embodied quality, it deepens the relationship that we have even with the voice on the radio.
Yes.
This is all part of your point that we're now attending to beyond the verbal text. And there has been, for a long period of time, an overemphasis on the content of what is said versus the rhythm and now the voice with which it is said, which we're addressing.
I think about the NPR commentator, Terry Gross. It's not just what she says and the fact that she asks good questions, but it's the whole kind of spirit and mood that's suggested by the tone of her voice. that I think makes her especially attractive as an interviewer. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of voices, attractive or otherwise, why don't we go to sample two for a very different audio experience?
Okay, so sample two is when we first meet the Queen of the Night, and she is presenting herself as a victim in need of help. She wants Tamino to realize that she's an aggrieved mother, terrible misfortune has fallen to her, and So I call this the Soft Queen, just for convenience on my list here. Let me get to it here.
Certainly a welcoming sound.
She seems like a friendly presence to me.
Yeah, lovely, right.
Well, you know, I was thinking, Lee, maybe we should hear the other example of the Queen, so then we get, you know, the range of registers and and emotions.
Yes.
And then we can talk about, you know, how the music is so uniquely able to convey that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll go to the third example, which is the angry, vengeful queen. This is her famous aria where she hits the F above high C, which is the note that only certain sopranos are able to reach.
And it's when she's thwarted, when Tamino is not doing her bidding, and her daughter is not agreeing to murder her father on her behalf, and she's less than happy about it.
Yes, that's an understatement, right? She presents quite a different face. So here we go.
Thank you.
that's a different queen.
And I trust we have all had patients who at various times or under various stressors in their own way represent that tone of voice when thwarted or disappointed or painfully frustrated. And not to externalize it, it's not something that we can't find in ourselves. I mean, these are imagos. I think that's why it works, because it speaks to all the levels in all of us humans.
Yeah. All the characters, I think, in the opera really are, you know, parts of ourselves at certain moments and parts of our patients. That aria, you know, makes me think about moments when a patient was really raging at me. You know, that just intense, explosive rage that recent excerpt conveys. But it's so complex. You know, going back to that Wagner quote, just again, he talks about that music is capable of 1,000 shades of suggestion that are beyond the capacity of words. And the poet, Heine, he's quoted as saying, where words leave off, music begins. And in these musical examples, you can come up with, you know, different shadings of feeling and mood. For example, in the two that we've just heard, we heard sadness, we heard a kind of imploring quality, maybe somewhat self-pitying in the first excerpt. In the second one, we hear rage, but we also hear a kind of vengefulness. We also hear a kind of power, the demonstration of, look what I can do with my voice. It reminds me a little bit, if you read sometimes professional reviews of a certain wine, the experts will list, you know, 6 or 8 different tastes in the wine, some of which you've never even heard of. But if you really, you know, pay attention to it, you can begin to discern these things. And I think that's true with operatic music and to some degree with voices in conversation.
The interest in this opera, too, that there are at least 3 places where what's sung are sounds, not words. At the beginning, when Papageno claims that he killed the dragon, a boastful lie, he is he's punished by the 3 ladies, they make him mute, and so he can only go and he's only making sounds. Then you have this in the aria of the Queen of the Night, you have the same thing. And later, sounds, pure sounds, not words. And then later in the, when Papageno finally meets Papagena, they have a very comical aria that I don't even know if it has any words. It's mostly sounds.
That's meant as a teaser to the listeners to go either Spotify the opera or go see the opera. It's a delightful little Papageno interlude. But let me draw us, just because of time, to Zarastro, because this really is the setting, in contrast to the first voice, which is a boy child, and the second voice, which is I guess we could call it a false pleading, and then a terrifying, destructive, high-pitched woman's voice. This is sort of also a cartoon of the ever-present, ever-wise, ever-accepting man in this basso profundo voice, which is really quite lovely and quite moving. And you could see how it could be the end of the opera, but as we spoke earlier, it really begs to take it to a third step, which I'll ask you to elaborate on in a minute, but why don't we hear it?
So the lyrics that he's singing have to do with behavior and sensibility in the holy temple of which he presides over, and he's instructing others. Thank you. That'll give you good.
Yeah, that's a father anybody would want. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He would calm everybody down.
Absolutely, right. And be welcoming. Yeah.
I was just thinking that we don't have any duets in the musical examples. Mm. So in the opera, there are a number of duets and larger vocal ensembles. But just to focus on duets for a moment, that's another area where there are implications for the consulting room. You know, when you hear the way that the voices interact with each other, complement each other, sometimes clash with each other, and so on. And some people have written about this. I think Robert Grossmark talks about duetting in the psychoanalytic situation, that the way that we respond, you know, that we may be responding in a way that sort of supports in a harmonic way, or that may interject, or may capture the same rhythm or some of the same qualities of voice. And not only does that expand the range of listening possibilities, but people like Grossmark and various other people also really focus on how that kind of musical verbal interchange has mutative qualities in itself. Daniel Stern's work also, you know, and others who have studied infant-mother interactions have also written about this, that some of what happens in terms of mutative factors in analytic work has to do with these nonverbal kinds of communications and interactions. Hmm.
Cross-modal attunement, is that what Stern calls it? Maybe the little child throws the ball up in the air and the mother says, woo, you know, makes a sound.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's the sing-song, you know, back and forth, the vocalizations back and forth between mother and infant.
Call and response. Yeah. Lee, do you want to say anything briefly about the missing act? And then I'm going to ask you each to talk a little bit about what brought you here. But I want to honor that part of your chapter where you raise the question about the third act.
Yeah, it's funny how I'm here partly because I heard the magic flute when I was 13. It was performed, it was the first opera I ever went to. My father took me to it. It was in Munich in a marionette theater that is several hundred years old and specializes. It's a very nice small opera house for marionettes to perform operas to soundtracks. And I was really enchanted by this. And for a long time, it was really the only opera I could relate to, partly as a shared thing with my father, I'm sure, and a moment from that experience. But it is the thing that opened up opera over time. The theme that I ended up writing about in my chapter of bringing paternal and maternal together, dialectics, but as integrations, is something that started coloring my work about 20 years ago when a candidate asked me to discuss their paper, in which they were very confused as a candidate at the Institute about what different supervisors were offering. Certain supervisors seemed to have push her towards having a what she called a stand back position, where she commented as if she weren't involved. And others wanted her to be more in there, more like a mother fussing. And she couldn't figure out how to put these two things together. And that became part of her graduation paper. And I wrote a paper in response to that for discussion. And eventually our two papers were published in the same journal. And I noticed that she presented more the clinical, I presented more the theoretical. But I noticed that our great theorists, who for me are Freud, Klein, Winnicott, Bion primarily, many others, but they could be classified according to how much their style of intervention and approach seemed to be paternal function, that is, coming in from the outside as a third and asking a little bit more of the patient, maybe in a confrontative way. I think Freud and Melanie Klein fit that, versus a Winnicott with more of a maternal function, where he would just allow whatever happened to happen and play along, wiggle game, so on and so forth, without a lot of pressure to make something happen, which is characteristic of paternal function, as it's been written about.
You mean maternal function?
These days, I think you want to add the paternal function and maternal function. They may no longer be the best terms for these things as we move out of certain gender stereotypes that used to be more usable than perhaps where we're moving into. But that this isn't a gender thing. It's it's an approach of immersion versus confrontation. And that became a big part of my teaching over the years, because I noticed that my supervisees would gravitate towards theories in which they felt most emotionally comfortable. Some could not be very maternal. They would just feel uneasy. And they were sort of tougher, more demanding types. And others were very hesitant about confronting a patient. I don't mean in the sense of really facing a patient with something that they really had to face. Confrontative sounds too aggressive. But then not everybody felt comfortable even giving an interpretation. It felt to some too disruptive.
They thought it was too aggressive too.
Too aggressive. So I got the idea that we'd have to bring all the, we'd have to be a complete analyst with all, making use of all the arrows provided to the analytic quiver over the years by the geniuses in the field. We'd have to do some integrating work on our own about mother and father, paternal and maternal. And that's what I noticed did not happen in The Magic Flute. And so as a kind of interesting writing idea, it led me to suggesting that perhaps we need another act in which those two could be brought together.
Thank you for sharing that, right. Steve, your closing comments?
Well, yeah. I think, you know, for me, my mother was a talented amateur musician. And growing up, I would hear her quite often sitting at the piano, accompanying herself while she would sing. These were Broadway show tunes. But I think that really had a, you know, quite an impact on me. And probably, you know, has something to do with my love of music in general, but also I have a particular affinity for vocal music, including opera. So that was one influence. And, you know, I would say I really was turned on to opera in college in a very, very wonderful full year music history course. That had a big impact. So I did start going to operas, and then moving to San Francisco with really a wonderful opera company here, and many friends and colleagues who also were enjoying opera. You know, I had a chance to get more deeply immersed. But I must say that it really was the collaboration of opera on the couch, doing these discussions over a period now of, you know, between 10 and 15 years, and getting increasingly interested in the operas and delving more deeply into them, becoming more interested in the musical aspects and how, and this kind of bi-directional influence between psychoanalysis and opera and so on. I think that that's really what brought me anyway to wanting to put together this edited book of psychoanalytic contributions to opera.
Let me mention the name of the book again, Opera on the Couch, Music, Emotional Life, and Unconscious Aspects of Mind. Let me thank you both for many things, one of which is since we started talking about this, I had the pleasure to re-listen to the opera many times, and it's such a source of pleasure on many levels, as we've been talking, pure musical delight, but also revisiting the developmental lines that speak to me and others so clearly and so illuminatingly. And I recommend the book. There are many chapters that are rich and thought-provoking and add a great deal to the opera experience. You two are great. I appreciate your working hard and putting this musical presentation together. I am sure our listeners will appreciate it and enjoy it. And I wanna thank you both for all you've contributed.
Thank you so much, Harvey, for having us. But also, clearly, you've really, really delved into the book and thought about it. And
we appreciate that.
Yeah, it really warrants it.
One final word to anybody who's interested and would like to pursue opera further. Before buying the book or buying the CD, go to the opera, because there is nothing that the opera really is being in a theater with a live orchestra amongst people who appreciate it, and watching a kind of ritual of new performers replacing those who have gone before them and putting new life into these dramas. It's like a really living thing. And you can't get that from anywhere else except the experience. And
well, that's so, for sure. But I think that you can get quite a bit also from the video performances. Met Opera on Demand.
Yeah.
Is a large archive of both audio recordings and video performances, including two of the Magic Flute, which I highly recommend.
Your example of the pleasure of new generation stepping up, hopefully that applies to psychoanalysis as well. And let's leave it at that. So nice to spend time with you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.